This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A report from the Pew Charitable Trust last year found that family background is strongly linked to lifetime earnings, meaning that someone born rich is likely to grow up and become wealthy, while someone born poor is not likely to escape poverty. David Grusky is one of the authors of that Pew report. He's also the director of Stanford University's Center on Poverty and Inequality. Grusky will speak at Kalamazoo College on Tuesday. His address is called The Death of the American Dream. David Grusky, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to be here.
So as we speak right now, what condition would you say the American dream is in? Is it truly dead at this point? Is it on life support, critical condition?
I would say critical condition is a fair assessment. We're not living up to what many regard as one of our most fundamental principles, that it shouldn't matter whether your parents are rich or poor in determining what your chances are for getting ahead. And what the evidence suggests loud and clear is that it matters a lot. If you're so lucky as to be born into a well-off family, that is going to, on average, mean you'll make a lot more over the course of your own lifetime.
You have said that it's not surprising that someone born into a wealthy family enjoys advantages, and we should probably say here that that will always be the case. But is what we're getting at here the degrees, the extent to which where you're born, what sort of family you're born into is going to determine what happens over your lifetime?
I think that's absolutely right. It's a matter of the extent to which we deviate. And there's been a bit of dissensus in the literature over just how strong that relationship is between how well off one's parents are and where you end up with respect to how much money you get as a child and then as an adult. There's been some dissensus, and some of the survey results that came in earlier suggested we had a very strong association between the two generations that put us at the very top of where countries stand on this. And then some of the later evidence coming in from tax return data suggested that maybe it's not quite as bad as we had thought. And so we entered into this research trying to adjudicate between those two views. And what we found was that indeed there's a very strong association between where you start off and where you end up, and that our worst fears in that regard, the fears that came out of some earlier surveys, were borne out.
So if someone were sitting down right now and trying to construct the policies that would get at the issue of income inequality, and they got on an elevator with David Grusky and asked his opinion of it, and you had to give your elevator speech about how to tackle this issue, what would that be?
I would first stress the point that there are many ways we can take this problem on, but the scale of the effort has to be in excess of what many people have appreciated. We cannot do the minor incremental interventions of the sort that we now currently undertake and expect that a problem of this magnitude to just go away. So the real problem is the scale of our efforts. They're not at all up to the task. They're not at all up to the magnitude of the problem that we're facing. I can talk more, but I think the scale issue is so important, and that has to be appreciated from the get-go. And then we can talk about various ways in which we can undertake this major effort. But if we're really serious about living up to this commitment, then it's going to have to be a big effort. And I should say, in the past, the country has undertaken big efforts. When we've fallen short of our principles, our most sacred commitments, we have undertaken major institutional reform. That's what makes this country amazing, is that we think our institutions are perfectible, constantly being created and recreated. So we've done it in the past when we found ourselves falling short, and we would just have to undertake something of that magnitude once again. I'm happy to talk more about what we might do, but I think the scale issue is very, very important.
Well, can you give us an example? You mentioned that the United States has tackled big issues in the past when we felt that we were not living up to the ideals of this nation. So is there one example that stands out to you of where the United States has done that in the past, and that would be sort of the blueprint for how we would go at income inequality?
I was all ready to respond because the first part of the question, I think, is straightforwardly answered. Namely, I mean, you think about slavery, deeply inconsistent with the country's principles. And at the end of the day, we undertook some reforms. Reforms that are still in process and incompletely carried out. But nonetheless, we undertook major reforms and addressed the problem in a serious way. It was hard. It was difficult. It was a civil war. But we did it. Because our institutions weren't consistent with what we believed in. So that would be a good example. Would the same sort of recipe be required for this particular problem? No, I don't think so. I think it's a bit different. There are basically two ways that one could imagine going about addressing the problem. If opportunity is truly for sale, and it is, then one way to go would be to simply provide poor people with more money, money that would then allow them to buy opportunity for their children. That's option one. Option two is to, in effect, decommodify. It's to say that, well, poor people don't have the money to buy opportunity for their kids, so those types of opportunities have to be directly provided to their children so that they can compete on a more equal footing with other children whose parents have more money.
So one option would be that poor people are given money and they can pursue some of the same opportunities. I guess one question that would come up is, well, should the money be restricted in that way? In other words, that it's a voucher or something where it could be for educational purposes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that is a key question. There's lots of research showing that unfettered access to money to be deployed to meet whatever the basic needs that parents find themselves facing, that unfettered money is immensely valuable and has immense payoff. But the more pragmatic position here is that for lots of reasons, folks in our country are more comfortable with putting restrictions on the money, either directly delivering services or providing vouchers that in other ways limit the ways in which these monies can be deployed. So I think we have to be realistic about what people in this country prefer and just get the job done. There's lots of ways to get the job done.
Well, let's talk about that other idea of perhaps decommodifying. Is that more or less saying that there are certain things in this country that are just too important to make a profit off of, and therefore they have to be nonprofit or have to be run by the government?
I think that's absolutely right. There are some things, the market's a wonderful institution, right, in allocating scarce resources. It works for all sorts of commodities, but one commodity that we might well say is sacred and shouldn't be distributed in accord with who has the money to buy it, one commodity is opportunity. That's something that we have committed from the get-go as something that should be available to everyone. It's not allocated in accord with how much money your parents have, but all children, no matter where the stork drops them, all children should have that. So it has to be something that's removed from the market and that is provided to all children so everyone has a fair chance at getting ahead. Level playing field. So yeah, I think that would be the rationale for if you will, decommodifying opportunity.
So how far does that go? Would that mean that there are no longer any private schools in the United States, for instance, that everything, if you're going to go to school, it's going to be a public institution?
That would be one way to go. Yeah, absolutely.
Would you favor that?
I suppose I would want to answer that question in one of two ways. If I had the capacity, if I were king for a day and could set up institutions entirely afresh without any concern about what the public might support, without any concern about transition costs from one regime to another, then I think that would be a very smart move. Take that out of the private sector and say this is something that is best handled by the government. But in the world as it now is, and recognizing that there's a public that has certain preferences and sensibilities, and that we've made certain investments, that probably is not a very realistic position to take. And rather, we simply want to ensure that a basic standard of high-quality primary secondary schooling is available to all children. Of course, you can let well-off parents spend on private schools, that's fine, but we ought to make sure that all children, no matter how poor their parents are, have access to high-quality public and private schooling.
You've argued that Americans really don't view the safety net properly, a series of programs for people who are of lower income, and that we tend to, as Americans, view this as a government charity. How should we be thinking about the safety net?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we should think about it as a set of institutions that we've committed to as a country for the purposes of leveling the playing field, for ensuring that some amount of opportunity is available even to children who are born into poor families. So it should be understood as one of our country's great institutions that realizes one of our most important commitments, namely to a fair and equal race in which everyone, no matter how poor their parents may be, everyone can compete equally. So yeah, it should be our cherished institution. That means we should really work hard to make sure they're formulated in ways that we think are the right ways. Like there shouldn't be disincentives built in to our safety net institutions, such that people aren't incentivized to work. Of course, we want to have the right incentives being delivered by those institutions. But that's a matter of tinkering that's very consistent with, again, this American sensibility that our institutions are perfectible. But the general idea behind these institutions should be one that we find expressing some of one of our most sacred principles.
How would you build a better safety net? How would you get at the idea that I think many people do hold dear, that there should be a way that we are not just simply helping people that are in poverty for now, but actually helping them find a way out of poverty into self-sufficiency?
Yeah. Well, that's the million-dollar question. But I think, again, a lot of what we need to do is simply ramp up our existing safety net institutions. It's a relatively poorly funded set of institutions as compared to what prevails in other equally well-off countries. And so we just need to ramp it up. So, for example, in California, there are lots of low-income families who simply don't have access to high-quality early childhood education. We have many organizations in play that are delivering that service to low-income children, but there are many, many low-income families that simply don't have those slots available to them. So we need to ramp that up, right? And that kind of ramping up holds, I think, across the board. We just need to do more. We've learned a lot from the war on poverty, what works and what doesn't work, and now we just need to exploit what we've learned and do more of it.
How do you make the case to someone who feels that they're in a fairly comfortable situation right now financially? They are looking at their own children, their own family, and saying, hey, I want to make a better life for them. How do you convince them that it's in their interest, as well as the family that's not as well off, to have policies which expand opportunity, even if it might mean perhaps, you know, higher taxes or something like that for a family that's well off?
What a great question. I think there are a lot of people who believe deeply in what are seen as prototypically American commitments, like this commitment to equal opportunity, and they're willing to pay for it. They love their country. They want their country to live up to everything that it aspires to be, and they're willing to step up and pay for it. So I'm not all that worried about that being a problem. If we can make it very clear that this set of investments in these certain institutions will ensure that we as a country can live up to what we believe in and we can compete well against other countries that are better at delivering equal opportunity. If we can make that case, and I think we can, then I think people will step up. And indeed, there's likely going to be an initiative in California in 2018 that will ramp up the safety net institutions in the way that I've discussed. And there's some early evidence in terms of polling that suggests that Californians would be quite willing to undertake the necessary investments.
David Gruske, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It was great to talk.
David Gruske is the director of the Stanford University Center on Poverty and Inequality. He will speak on Tuesday at Kalamazoo College. Gruske's address at 8 o'clock in the Olmsted Room at Mandel Hall is called The Death of the American Dream. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.